Welcome to another episode of the Gunblog Variety Cast with your hosts, Sean Sorrentino and Aaron Paulette. Sitting in for Aaron this week is Weirdbeard.
Welcome to episode 167 of Gunblog Variety Cast Radio, a proud member of the Self-Defense Radio Network. How are you doing, Weird?
I'm doing pretty good. I'm a little tired, but not as bad as I expected.
Well, Aaron's out again this week. She's still not quite up to doing the show, but we do have a segment from her later, so stick around. So, Weird, what's going on with you this week?
My daughter woke me up at midnight last night and demanded I read an entire Captain Underpants book to her, which was not going to happen.
How long are Captain Underpants books?
It's 200 pages, but it's heavily illustrated, so I could probably, you know, with little interruptions and daddy, I can't see the picture situation, I could probably bang one out in about 45 minutes.
So we're not talking like War and Peace here.
We're not talking Stephen King's It.
Yeah. But we're also not talking the monster at the end of this book.
No.
Yeah. So I can see that. So woke you up at midnight, kept you up, made you read from her book.
Yeah. No. She's just like I said last week, she had an ear infection. I realized we caught it early enough that I was able to still ship her up to my parents' place. And so she was out of town for a few days, but grandparents got plans and they run her hard. And so she comes home tired. And so I've just been trying to get her back into bed and, you know, get to sleep. Come on, we got to catch up. She's waking up as a bear. And then suddenly she's up at midnight. I'm like, come on, this is not helping things. So yeah, so I'm putting up an ad on Craigslist. Contact me in the show page if you're interested in an adorable four-year-old daughter.
You gonna want her back when she's 10, 12, or are you just
no. We're all done here. She's had all her shots,
and it hasn't turned her autistic. So you know you're over that hump.
I don't know. I'm not a physician. I can't tell if she's autistic or not.
Oh, well, I am given to understand that occasionally the dogs force my wife out of bed early, early, early and say we need to go outside. I have not woken up for any of this, so I can't independently verify this happens, but my wife insists that it does.
They need to scream louder and touch you on the face.
On the other hand, I do get up at 5 o'clock every morning, and from 5:30 to 6:30 in the morning, I walk Dices.
I got up at 5 o'clock this morning. Actually, it was a smoke detector. It really was not a good night's sleep for me last night.
I do notice that I can text you at that time in the morning and I get an answer pretty quickly.
Oh yeah. No, I'm up at 5 just about every morning. That's kind of my go-to. I would have liked it to been like 5:30, but it was actually 4:45 with my wife going, oh, I think a smoke detector's going off. And of course it's chirping. And as I go to get a battery, I hear it chirp again. And then finally, when I come upstairs, it's all done chirping. It must be some sort of low voltage thing. I need to talk to my electrical engineer friends and figure out what that is.
So I just pulled it up, walking the dog every morning, plus a mile in the evenings. I am at, with Dices, 6,127.52 miles with this dog.
Plus you've got two dogs, so you could double dip now.
Actually, I don't take credit for, I never walk that dog alone. So she's with Dices when we're walking. And I don't track the mileage on her because mostly she's my wife's dog. She's still afraid of me.
Dog walking miles. If you walk two dogs 5 miles, you've got 10 dog walking miles. It's like man hours.
Okay. I'll keep that in mind. But 6,127 point something or other, that's a long way. It just adds up after a while.
Yeah, it does.
So if you want to get to walking, get yourself a dog. They will make you get up in the morning and walk. So my P320 Compact is back. Remember last week we talked about I had just mailed it off. I just received a note. It was Thursday. I just got my note. Said, hey, this is here at SIG. Good job.
Yep.
It was back 8 days after I dropped it in the mail. It was a 2-day ship there. Thursday they said, yep, we've got it. I think it was Tuesday morning that I got the email that said, oh, last night we shipped this to you. It'll be there Wednesday. So Wednesday, up rolls the FedEx truck. I'm running out there. Give me my gun. Of course, wait, I can't say that. May I have my package, please? I will try not to look too excited that I'm getting
it. The FedEx guys know. I've got a CNR. So yeah, no, the guy's like, give it to me. I'm like, that's a rifle, isn't it? Yeah, it's a rifle.
Yeah, but this is a nondescript box, just barely big enough to put the SIG box inside. In fact, I saved it because my competition gun is going to have to go back to Gray Guns when they call for it. So I saved the box because it is the perfect size to put the SIG box in.
Does it have an Exeter, New Hampshire return address?
I don't know. I didn't really look. I knew what it was, so I ripped it open as quickly as I could. It came with a 25% off coupon, so anything I buy from the SIG Pro Shop, I can get a 25% discount.
That's a 320. You should buy like some frames or slides or stuff. Get a 45 conversion kit.
I don't think you can convert it to 45. I'm not entirely certain how it works. And I have really honestly no interest in converting it to 45. I've got a 45 caliber pistol. What I am interested in is just to have it, a caliber exchange kit to 40. Because what happens if there's no ammunition? There's always 40 because nobody shoots that crap. Because it's like the worst caliber ever. Neither fish nor fowl. It's not any better than 9. It doesn't have the excitement factor of 45 for the old guys. And it doesn't do anything better than anything else. So, like, for civilians, there's no point in having it unless you happen to be shooting USPSA in the limited division. If USPSA one day said, you know what, on the street, there's no difference between being shot with a 9 and being shot with a 45, so we're going to get rid of major minor power factor, the 40 would cease to exist overnight. But still, nobody buys it. So there's always plenty of it, even when there's no ammunition. So I have this terrible urge to buy the caliber exchange kit just so I can shoot 40 if there's nothing else available.
And those who listen to me on Handgun Radio, I will quickly add that for a slightly larger charge, you can buy yourself a 357 SIG barrel and then have yourself 3 calibers. And on top of that, if you're carrying a gun in 357 SIG, all you need is a pork pie hat and let your facial hair grow out a little bit, and you're a perfect hipster.
I was thinking that I wanted 357 SIG Ackley improved.
Is there such a thing?
No, I'm just stealing Tam's jokes again. I mean, literally, we could run this podcast just on stealing Tam's jokes. It'd be probably a lot better. So I checked out the gun. I checked out the trigger, the double click. I don't know how many people know about it, but if you dry fire the original SIG P320 trigger, you can get this sort of double click at the end of the trigger pull. The first one is the striker firing. The second one, if I understand correctly, is the disconnector disconnecting or something.
Be disconnector disconnect. Oh, yeah.
And what that does is it allows you to pull the trigger again and get another click. It doesn't do anything to the striker. The striker's not going to fall again. You don't have double strike capability. But you could dry fire with the thing, and it's really awesome. I love it. Well, the double click is gone, apparently because the Army objected to it. Of all the stupid things to focus on, that's what the Army focused on. Oh, it's got this funny double click. And it got rid of the dry fire click too. So I'm very upset about that. The trigger feels nice, but I'm kind of upset that I don't have a dry fire click. All I've got is a mushy springy pull at the second, you know, on the second and third and 18th pull. I got one click when I dropped the striker and then a bunch of mush pulls, which is, I guess, better than the Glock. So I don't have to stick something in the slide to keep it open, but I really miss my dry fire click.
Yes, Sean, since you both carry a SIG 320 and shoot one in competition, Ryan and I are definitely going to have you on Handgun Radio to talk about that weapons platform.
Well, hopefully I won't come across like the complete not gun geek that I am. But yeah, we'll give it a try.
We'll fix it in post.
I'm sorry. I don't think you can make me smarter in post. You can get rid of some of the dumb things I say, but that's about it. If the entire interview is me saying dumb things, you're kind of screwed. So speaking of shooting competition, I'm going to be going out this Saturday, which will be the day before the podcast drops, and I'm shooting the classifier again. The last time I shot the classifier, I shot sharpshooter, and I barely made sharpshooter, but I shot it with the carry gun. It was because it was before I even got the full size gun. So I've got the full size, I've got the competition trigger, I've got the competition sights. I am hoping to do at least a very solid sharpshooter. And maybe I can push that a little farther, but the only important thing is I'm going to be shooting my best by calling my shots. I'm not going to rush, try, and hurry. I'm just going to go out and shoot it and see what happens. So expect a range report next week. Weird, have you ever gone out and looked in the mailbox and said, why the hell did somebody send this to me?
So often.
It's amazing. When you're a little kid and you get something in the mail, it's like freaking Christmas, isn't it? And when you're an adult, if anything comes in the mail that's good, it's like, wow, when did this happen?
I heard a joke on Facebook that the motto of the U.S. Post Office should be, U.S. Post Office, can you throw this away for me?
You know? So you remember the whole situation with the glass top range that we had, right?
I do.
As we're doing show prep, the wife goes out and she gets the mail from the, you know, the post office person just drive up into the driveway. I was telling her, hey, they know the postal lady's here. She goes out, she gets the mail, she comes back and she hands this to me and she says, do you want to burn this or shall I? What I got is from Frigidaire, the people who made the crappy glass top stove that it came with the house. We wouldn't have picked it. Would you like to buy an extended warranty on your Frigidaire glass top stove that you've already called and told us broke the second time? For only $78.69, we can extend our coverage plan 1 year. Yeah, that thing's probably in the dump. We don't care where it went. We paid a couple extra bucks and had the people who got us the new stove haul the old one away because we were tired of looking at it. Because the next step was, I don't know how much Tannerite you can put on the front of one of those things, but I'm pretty sure we can put that sucker in orbit.
Yeah, that would be, so long as you said front, not inside. Do not put Tannerite inside of a stove.
I'm clear on that. You should never, ever, ever put something between you and an explosive because all that will do is turn into a projectile flying straight back at you. See also the idiot who blew up his lawnmower and lost his leg.
Ooh, yeah, that was a bad one.
So don't do that. But I'm pretty sure we could make that thing go orbital. Maybe we could put it like underneath. Is that okay?
Survey says no.
Can we do it anyway? Because I'd love to see that thing hit, you know, 500-600 feet.
So long as I'm not in the state.
I'll ask around. Maybe we can find somebody who's got some dynamite or something really big.
Do it like that Barry the Anvil trick.
Oh, yeah. Like anvil shooting. Have you seen that? Yeah. That's neat. But they do that with black powder, I think. They just like fill up the hole in the foot of the anvil and put the other anvil on top of it and then blow it up. Oh, that's cool. Check that out. Find that on YouTube. If you've never seen anvil shooting, just look up shooting anvil or anvil shooting and see if you find it. It's pretty cool. A quick reminder, search for GBVC Radio on Facebook and join the group. Comment, like, share, tell us all about what you think of this podcast and this episode of this podcast. Now, Weird, you have at least one more chance to do our spot just perfect to make Aaron happy. Can you do it?
I can. Thanks to Lucky Gunner and Remington for their support of the Gunblog Variety Cast Radio. From Golden Saber to Range Rounds, get a full lineup of quality Remington ammo that ships fast at LuckyGunner.com.
And see, that sounds like kind of like a late night. Can you do morning drive time?
Thanks to Lucky Gunner and Remington for their support of Gunblog Variety Cast Radio. From Golden Sabers to Range Rounds, get a full lineup of quality Remington ammo that ships fast at LuckyGunner.com.
Well, there you go, Aaron. There's two to choose from. So let's get on with the show. Murder insurance. That's what some anti-gun people are calling paid self-defense plans. Our own Beth Alcazar, who works for a company which offers such plans, talks about her encounter with the media on this issue.
It seems that nowadays gun grabbers are going after much more than just our firearms. Obviously, they've had an opportunity to go after a lot of accessories, ammunition, and now it seems they're going after self-defense insurance. Not too long ago, I was contacted by a local TV station, and they wanted to chat about NRA's new carry guard insurance. Of course, since I work for the United States Concealed Carry Association, I responded that I wouldn't really be able to say anything about carry guards since that is a direct competitor of our USCCA shield. But I was very intrigued by what they wanted to know, and since I do work with a company that offers insurance along with training and education, I felt like maybe I had something to offer. When the gentleman arrived to do the interview, it was amazing how, even though he didn't seem to have an ulterior motive or a personal opinion, apparently he had talked to some other people already about what they had termed murder insurance. What was shocking to me is it wasn't just the gun grabbers. It wasn't just those people who are vehemently and obviously against us having firearms for protection for our families and for our homes. He was also getting the same kind of fear and misunderstanding from law enforcement officers. Of course, even though I painstakingly took my time to make sure he understood that by no way, shape, or form do we, or any other companies I'm aware of, offer murder insurance, he seemed to keep coming back around to that terminology. I find it just absolutely appalling. I mean, come on, people. You have health insurance. You have insurance on your home. You have insurance on your car. And I don't see anybody racing around in their vehicles thinking, well, heck, I've got insurance now, so I can run over people and disobey the laws and just basically do whatever I want to. Apparently, though, that is the view when it comes to self-defense insurance. Apparently, if a responsible gun owner gets insurance as just a safety net should anything ever happen, that's just justification for us to, what, go out on a rampage? It's absolutely ridiculous. And it goes back to the idea that bad people and people with evil intent and violent criminals aren't the ones seeking out self-defense insurance. They're not the ones calling the USCCA to sign up for our new elite membership. They could not care less. Those who are seeking out this membership, this insurance, are those who are concerned that if, as a last resort, they had to use a firearm or, frankly, any weapon of opportunity, that someone would take them to that civil court. That's what we're worried about. We're worried about the financial aftermath, the legal aftermath, the ramifications that come with that morally and spiritually as well. No responsible gun owner that I know of wants to use his or her gun. No responsible gun owner that I know of thinks that having a concealed carry permit or having self-defense insurance is all of a sudden a reason to be aggressive or violent. And it's certainly not an excuse or some kind of permission to actually go hunting people down. I mean, we've heard this saying before that we don't carry firearms because we hate people in front of us. We carry firearms because we love the people behind us. That's an act of protection. That's an act of selflessness. That's an act of sacrifice. That's not murder insurance. That's not some kind of stupidity that all of a sudden us gun owners are going to gang up together and blur the lines. And those are the exact terms of some of the folks that were interviewed, that this insurance blurs the lines somehow. Well, you know what? I think the only people it will blur the lines for are those who are not paying attention, those who are misinformed, or those who just don't care to know the truth. The responsibly armed Americans don't see any blurred lines because we're responsible, because we make wise decisions, and because we choose to obey the law at all times. Anyway, I'm sorry to go on this crazy rant, but I thought it was important to share that not only are those anti-gun folks attacking the firearms themselves, attacking our ammo, attacking our accessories, now they're looking at even insurance as a way to point fingers and to place blame on the good guys. So be aware, be alert, and stay vigilant out there. And as always, stay safe and be well armed.
You can read more from Beth at usconcealedcarry.com/blog and click on Pacifiers and Peacemakers in the left sidebar.
This podcast runs on your donations. Go to gunblogvarietycast.com and click on the donate or the subscribe button in the right sidebar. You can make a one-time donation of any amount or subscribe for as little as $2 a month. I know that doesn't sound like much, but we pay our server costs monthly, and a little help from you is a big help to us.
Felons behaving badly. Police find gun after teen led officers on a chase through Charlotte. Dateline Charlotte, North Carolina. Charlotte Mecklenburg police officers said a dive team found a gun that may be connected to a shooting and police chase that happened Saturday. Channel 9 cameras saw crews searching the Catawba River at the Wilkinson Boulevard Bridge Saturday evening and into Sunday. A teenager is in custody after police said he fired a gun into a home Saturday afternoon and then led police on a chase in West Charlotte. Officers responded to an assault with a deadly weapon call just before 2 p.m. on the 8,000 block of Lobelia Lane. Police said a home was shot into, but there were no injuries. Officers charged suspect, 19, with felony discharge of a firearm. That's probably discharge of a firearm into an occupied property. Just a tip. An officer told Channel 9 they were searching for evidence and said they found a gun. Officers later located the suspect's vehicle and attempted to initiate a traffic stop. Police said the driver of the vehicle led police on a pursuit that ended on Hathaway Hills Drive near the Gaston County line. Suspect's mother, who spoke exclusively to Channel 9, made an emotional plea to her son to pull over his car. The woman, who didn't want to be identified, said her son was wearing an ankle monitor but was on track to get his life back together. She said suspect was supposed to start school Monday, but right now he's being questioned about his possible involvement in a shooting by detectives. Okay, Aaron would shoot whoever wrote this. Was the shooting by detectives, or was he being questioned by detectives about his possible involvement in a shooting? Misplaced modifier, guys. Stop it. Suspect's mother said he called her during the pursuit, saying, "Mom, I'm in a high-speed chase. You know I didn't do anything. I was just leaving Family Dollar, and they got in behind me and started to chase me," the mother said. The mother confirmed that her teenage son was involved in a chase on the Gaston-Mecklenburg County line. "I was like, Bruce, if you know you haven't done anything, then just stop. Just stop," she said. Suspect's mother said he didn't pull over, so she tried to find him. At one point, she pulled in front of his car to try to slow him down. She ended up going to a gas station and asked police for help. He called suspect and told him, "You know I have your mom here. She's hysterical, and she wants you just to stop. Just stop," the mother said. The suspect said, "I'm afraid to stop. They're going to hurt me." The officer said, "No one's going to hurt you." The teen's mother said the chase ended peacefully in front of her home when he was taken into custody. "I'm disappointed on whatever is going on here, but I still love my son," the mother said. Detectives searched suspect's car and his mother's vehicle.
Oh man, just so many tropes on there. Like, all right, look, if you do something bad and the cops catch you doing it, don't make them chase you down. That's only going to piss them off.
Exactly. Like, if the cops got to chase you, they're bringing an ass whooping with them.
Thank you, Chris Rock.
It's like, seriously. But, you know, mom's interceded. He ran home and they just took him into custody there. So I guess he didn't get his butt kicked.
He's turning his life around, but he's wearing an ankle bracelet. And his mom said, if you didn't do anything, just pull over. And guess what he didn't do?
He didn't pull over. So yeah, he's on track for a number of problems here. And since he was wearing an ankle monitor, we know that he wasn't exactly, you know, the most upstanding citizen.
We know he's got a record, but how long is his jacket?
Possession of a weapon on campus, felon class I. 2 counts, felony breaking and entering, felon class H. Larceny of a motor vehicle, felon class H. Receiving, possessing firearm, felon class H. And possession of a firearm by a felon, felon class G.
And how old is this guy?
Well, according to the story, suspect is 19.
Man, that's pretty good. I mean, back when I was 19, I just had a couple of part-time jobs under my belt.
Well, Baron is on assignment.
You've heard Aaron talk about this before, but let me remind you. We're taking a survey of our listeners. We'd like you to participate. It will help us to learn more about you. No matter how long you've been a listener or how frequently you listen to the show, please take a few minutes and visit our website at gunblogvarietycast.com. You'll find the listener survey link at the top of the right sidebar. It's also in the show notes right at the top. And you can complete the survey anonymously. Thanks.
Miguel is on assignment.
Hi, everybody. This is Steve Denny from the Pro Arms Podcast, reminding you that this podcast is a member of the Self-Defense Radio Network. Check out the other podcast at selfdefenseradio.net.
Tiffany is on assignment.
So as you know, Erin still isn't up to taking back her full-time hosting gig. This week, we're fortunate that she did record a segment talking about the tragic dog bite and the aftermath thereof. I've already listened to this segment, and I'll warn you, Erin has understandably been through a lot, and there's a lot of raw emotions here. I'm certainly glad she shared them with us, and I look forward to her further recovery.
And now it's time for Blue Collar Prepping with that bratty kid sister of the gun blogosphere, Aaron Paulette.
Come on, every pony! It's time for Blue Collar Prepping with Aaron Paulette!
Hey, preppers. This is Aaron Paulette. It has been just a little over 2 weeks since I was mauled by my mom's dog. The swelling on my face is mostly down to normal, but as you can probably tell, I've got a little bit of a speech impediment. The reason for that is that I have stitches that are holding part of my lower lip together, and they actually go up to the corner of the mouth. So I can't open the right side of my mouth all the way because the corner of the mouth is stitched together. And I just got this big mass of scar tissue and probably clotted blood in there, and it's very awkward. So if I sound like I've got a mouthful of marbles or I can't say certain letters properly, you know, ironically, the letter P gives me problems. so it's difficult for me to say my name. So if you have problems understanding me, I apologize. I'm trying to take this slow and enunciate my words clearly so you can understand me. I'm sure you're all wondering how I'm doing. That's one of those questions that I'm not really sure how to answer, because it depends really on how I'm feeling at that point in time, and also because I don't know whether people mean physically or emotionally. So I'm just gonna start with one and lead into the other. I hope this doesn't get too graphic. You're not getting pictures, so that's a mercy. But, you know, if you find this too gross and you decide to skip ahead, I will not feel hurt by that, okay? You have my blessing. So, I was bitten by my mom's dog in two places. The first bite was on my upper lip on the left side of my face, and then the second bite was on the lower right. And so that tells me that I was jerking my head away. I actually can't really remember that part of the attack. Maybe later I'll be ready to talk about what happened, but not right now. So my upper lip was just bitten in some places. I required overall between 50 and 60 stitches. I asked the doctor how many, and he actually didn't know. He said that he kind of stopped counting somewhere after a dozen. He estimated between 50 and 60. The stitches on my upper lip were done with the dissolving type of stitches. Those have since dissolved, and my upper lip is doing mostly okay. I say mostly because I've got some fairly significant... See, there I go. I have some fairly significant scarring on my upper lip in two places, and it's swollen. I feel it just about every time I move my lip. And I don't know if that will ever go down. It might just be some swelling that will continue to shrink over time, or it might be scar tissue. Right now, it feels very hard, so it doesn't feel like it's just swelling. But I haven't really had a good consultation with the plastic surgeon about that. My upper lip is functional. Actually, I was told I was very lucky that none of the muscles got damaged. It was just my lips. I've got these two little hard nodules on my upper lip, and you know, they're bumping into my teeth, and I'm just constantly aware of them all the time. I do have some loss of sensation in my upper lip, and again, I'm not sure whether that's just due to the swelling and the scar tissue or if there's some nerve damage. This is just going to be something that I'll have to wait and see on. My lower lip was much worse. When the dog finished biting me, I had a chunk of my lip that was basically hanging on by what the doctors called a peninsula of flesh. And so it is a nearly perfect oval bite out of my lip and cheek. That required the majority of the stitches, both inside my mouth and on the outside. Now, I was very lucky in that, well, not only did the muscles not get hit, but within hours, I was seen by a very skilled plastic surgeon. How skilled was this guy? I don't remember the proper name for what he does, but this is a guy who went to dental school, became a dentist, then went to medical school and became a surgeon. So he has multiple doctorates in the mouth. So he knew what he was doing, and first he stitched up the inside, and they stitched up the outside. The internal stitches are dissolving slowly. I still feel them. They bug the heck out of me. I'm constantly worrying them with my tongue. The outer stitches. Last week, when I went to the plastic surgeon, and I had to go to the plastic surgeon because 2 days prior, I went to my primary care physician, and he looked at me, and he very politely said, he didn't say these exact words, but he said, I've never seen a dog bite that bad. And then he said that, first of all, my wound wasn't healed enough, and I wasn't ready to have the stitches taken out. And even if I was, he wouldn't take them out because that was above his pay grade. So on the one hand, I applaud the fact that he knew his limitations, but that was really discouraging to be told that I had to wait and that it was really that bad. So a couple of days later, I went to go see the plastic surgeon. I only got the stitches on the upper part taken off. Yeah, I'm gesturing like you can actually see my hand. I know how stupid that is. Yeah, I've got this more or less oval or football-shaped patchwork on my face. And so just sort of imagine that top part of the football, those stitches got taken out. And my next appointment with the plastic surgeon is on the 30th, and hopefully I'll get the rest of these out. Now, my lower lip is a concern to me, because even though the majority of the traumatized swelling has gone down, yeah, when I first had this happen, I could barely talk, and I mumbled a lot, and I got tired after talking for about 5 minutes because of all the work and because it pulled on my stitches. I'm doing a lot better now. But even though most of the swelling has gone down, so I no longer look like a monkey who has gone several rounds with the boxer and lost, I've still got this swollen nodule-looking thing on my face. It's really disgusting to look at. The skin is so bruised that it is black. This is a concern to me because the doctors told me that while they had done the best they could do in patching me up and they didn't expect any problems, there's always the chance that the skin was so traumatized that it could die, and that I need to be on the lookout for necrosis of the skin. And so I need to keep an eye on it and make sure it doesn't change into unhealthy colors or start oozing or smell. Well, so far, no smell and no oozing other than the constant ooze of blood around my sutures. But it's really hard to see any color change because it's so dark that it's black. I have a tendency to worry. Everyone else who sees it, I'm posting it to a very small closed group, says that, no, it's looking fine, the swelling's going down, that's just a really bad bruise. And the reason it's swollen is because it's filled with coagulated blood and dead skin and things like that. Me, I'm just worried that it might start to rot at any moment. So I'm just obsessing over this the way a teenager obsesses over an acne pimple right before a dance. So this level of worry is really not conducive to good mental health. Eating has been a problem for me. When I first started, I could only open my mouth about a quarter of an inch. And so I was eating soft foods like applesauce or scrambled eggs. And I ended up wearing a lot of it on my lips. And it was really infantilizing, and I hated it. I have since gotten a lot better. I can open my mouth more. I have graduated to shredded food, you know, like pulled pork and things like that. Now I'm getting to the point where I can take in larger bits of food, like chicken nuggets, but I still can't bite into, you know, the really good stuff. I am dying for a steak. I don't know how much people have really thought about this, but part of the satisfaction of food comes in the biting and the chewing. I don't know why. It might be psychological. It might be biochemical. Maybe chewing the food releases the flavors. I have no idea. But just the act of chewing food is something that is sorely missed here. And as soon as I get these stitches out, I'm going to eat the biggest steak I can fit into my mouth, and then I'm going to have a burger, and then I'm going to have all these things that I can't get into because I am dying for chewy and crispy things. But at least I'm not subsisting on pureed food anymore, which was pretty much the first week, and that sucked. I'm honestly not sure how well I'm sleeping. Well, I've always had a tendency towards insomnia. I don't know that it's any worse. I go to bed when I'm tired, but I feel like I'm not getting a whole lot of rest, and I don't know why. Which is probably as good a segue as any into the psychological. I don't know that I have PTSD. It's not like I really have flashbacks, but there are things which are difficult for me. Two examples here. When my... Well, he was my dog and he bit me and then he stopped being my dog. So there's that slip up. When he bit me, there was so much blood. Facial wounds just bleed like crazy. And there was blood everywhere. And I honestly, I don't really know how much, because I was thinking about other things at the time, but I just know I was dripping like crazy. So when I came back from the hospital, there is an obvious, much cleaner spot in the carpet where the blood had been cleaned up with carpet shampoo. It's not at all creepy that there are little outlines in the blood of my feet and my dog's feet. I was trying to describe to Mom what happened because she was in the bathroom and I was out in the TV room when I got bitten. So I was reenacting it for her. And the moment I bent down into the position I had, I don't really know what I felt, but I felt something and it felt really, really uncomfortable. It was almost like my body was panicking and it was going, don't do that, you'll get bitten again. And I remember when I did my several months long series about trauma, and I remember body posture. You know, when people, when they're sad, if they adopt the posture of sadness, they get sadder. And so you, if you adopt a cheerful posture, you get happier, things like that. And I figure I was just adopting the posture of being attacked and my body started to freak out again. And so that was not comfortable. And the thing is, that stain is right there. I walk past it multiple times a day and it bugs me. And it's not like we can throw something over it either, because I'll see that we covered it and I'll still see it. I don't know if cleaning the stain off completely or having everything stained equally or whatever, where I just don't see the outlines, I don't know if that would fix it or not. That's just something we're going to have to see as it goes. But yeah, having to see that multiple times is bothersome, and so I spend a lot of time back in my room. I also spend a lot of time back in my room so I don't have to talk to people. It's just easier not to. So the other thing was when Mom was driving me back to the hospital to see the plastic surgeon, and we took exactly the same route that she took when she drove me to the ER after my face had been ripped to pieces. That was just weird. We're in the same car, we're in the same positions, we're driving the exact same route, for basically the same purpose, and that was just highly uncomfortable to the point of, okay, Mom, let's go faster. Let's get past this. I don't want to be in this car anymore. I don't want to be here anymore. Maybe it is PTSD. I don't know. I mean, I've certainly been traumatized, so I think that's fair, but I don't really know enough about what it feels like. I'm sorry, I'm trying to hold it together so I don't start crying. So yeah, I cry a lot. My emotions are this up and down because I'm angry a lot and I'm sad a lot, and they sort of flow into each other. I'm sad, then I'm sad angry, then I'm angry, then I'm angry sad. It's really weird because, well, it's a weird feeling. I mean, I think this is understandable. I am upset that this happened, both because it hurt and because I'm injured and I'm scarred. It hurts emotionally because I feel like I was betrayed by a dog that I loved for... I'm sorry. We had him for 8 years. We had him since he was a puppy. And Mom and I were basically the parents. She was the food giver, I was the play giver. We were playing when he snapped and attacked me. And so I feel horribly betrayed, and I'm angry at him for attacking me, And yet at the same time, I have this really messed up survivor's guilt. Because, you know, as a result of this, he was put down. And so I feel responsible for his death, even though logically I know that I had nothing to do with it, that I am not at fault. But I still feel guilty for some stupid reason, because my brain is going, well, what could you have done differently? You know, maybe if you had fallen backwards instead of jerking to the side, you wouldn't have been hurt as much. And I tell myself that that doesn't matter. But my unconscious brain is just, it's messing with me. It's playing these really horrible what-ifs. And I don't even mean the whole, well, what if you hadn't played with him that night? You know, you'd be fine and your dog would be alive. I mean, that sucks. But there's also that whole, and I don't know why my brain is doing this, but it's doing that whole, which would you rather? Well, if you had a choice, you could be mauled by another dog, but your dog is fine. Or you could not be mauled, but you lose your dog. And I'm going, brain, why the hell are you doing this to me? This is not productive at all. I don't know why my brain is fixating on this, and it's really painful. And I really understand how people can end up drinking a lot because of this. So yeah, I told Mom that, and I told her this on the way to the hospital the first time. I told her, I'm not going to demand that he be put down for this. That's up to you. Because as of this point, he's no longer my dog. Because I felt that any dog which would attack me like this clearly doesn't love me, and therefore isn't my dog, and so I disowned him. And Mom talked it over with a veterinarian, and they both decided that the best thing to do would be to put him down because, well, the best way to describe this, and of course we don't know, we're just sort of guessing. I mean, he wasn't rabid, that's for sure. And people have said, oh, maybe he had epilepsy, maybe he had a stroke, whatever. I don't think so, because he was fine before, and then he was fine after. And really, that's what sucked, because I come home, I'm stitched, I'm in pain, and he's all happy to see me, waggy tail, kissy tongue. It would have been easier if he was an aggressive asshole, you know? Because then I would go, okay, that's no longer my dog. Just do what you need to. But he was back acting like my dog, and that was really tough. And so when Mom decided he needed to be put down, even though it wasn't my decision, even though I distanced myself, I still feel like that was my fault. And I don't know why, and I hate that. Survivor's guilt is really messed up, guys. So yeah, I feel hurt. I feel betrayed. And then some days I feel angry. It's like, you stupid dog. Why did you do that? Why? You know, and it's so weird to go from being sad that he's dead to wanting to beat him to death because he attacked me. Right, I actually lost a train of thought because I got sad. So right, I was saying that we ruled out the rabies. We don't think it was like a stroke or epilepsy. Honestly, the best way to describe it is just the dog had a psychotic break. Just for whatever reason, he just snapped. I mean, literally, duh. Literally and figuratively. And then I think once the attack was over, I mean, when I was getting ready to get in the car, he was coming up to me and wondering what was going on. So I don't know, maybe he had psychological problems. He was always very needy, had to be the center of attention, have all the toys, but never anything like this. So Mom and the vet decided that it was best to put him down because we didn't know if he would ever snap again. And to whom, you know, he might kill somebody the next time. What if he goes for somebody's throat? I don't even remember what day it was because that week just blurs into itself, but it was within 48 hours, I think, of me coming back from the hospital that they put him down. And Mom was there. We love our pets. And they're never alone when they die. I wasn't comfortable being there, but Mom was with him. And she held him when they administered the sedative, and she said goodbye. She held him while he died. So he wasn't alone, and he wasn't in pain. I've got to carry these scars with me now because all of our other dogs were sick. I mean, all the dogs we've ever put down, They have all been sick, and we were doing them a kindness. We were easing their pain. This dog, other than the psychotic break, was in great health. And I think that's one reason why I feel like I actually contributed to his death. Doesn't make sense, but there it is. That's something I've just got to carry with me, and the fact that I know that it's BS doesn't make it any easier. Then there's the emotional scars of being attacked. I am very aware now of the teeth in dogs' mouths. I mean, I always knew they were there intellectually, but now I'm really emotionally aware of them. It's a difference between going, oh yeah, dogs have teeth, and dogs have tiny knives right there. And then I'm going to be physically scarred, and the plastic surgeon made no bones about that. Yeah, I'm definitely going to be scarred. The question is going to be how badly I'm going to be scarred. That's a big concern of mine. A bigger concern of mine is if I'm going to lose any functionality. I don't want to talk like this the rest of my life. I don't know if I'm going to need reconstructive surgery to fix whatever is going on here. The uncertainty is really freaking me out. So I've been talking about this for a good long time, and I should probably wrap up. I'm sorry, I don't really have any prepping advice for you. Oh, here we go. I can do something here. There is actually an official scale of the severity of dog bites created by a gentleman known as Ian Dunbar. And this scale goes from 1 to 6. A level 1 bite is actually not a bite itself. It's just aggressive behavior but no skin contact by the teeth. So it's just a dog snapping. Then it goes up to skin contact by teeth but no puncture. A level 3 is punctures but not very deep. 4 is 1 to 4 punctures with a bite deeper than half the length of the dog's canine teeth. Level 5 is a multiple bite incident with at least 2 level 4 bites. And a level 6 means a bite so severe that the victim died. I suffered a level 5 bite because I was bitten twice. And I had just about half of my bottom lip nearly ripped off. If he had bitten any harder or I had jerked away, it would have been bitten off, torn off. And I really shuddered to think what would have happened next, like if he had eaten it or something. I apologize for not having a, prepping advice. You know, how does one prepare for a dog bite? Well, you don't get bitten. But this was a dog that I'd played with for 8 years, and I did not see it coming. So maybe next week or the week after that, I'll have something. But I wanted to give you at least something productive from this segment. And so I will include in the show notes a link to the description of the Dunbar scale for dog bite severity. Thank you to everyone who has asked about how I'm doing. I really do appreciate it. Thank you very much to everyone who has contributed to the GoFundMe. That's really been a blessing. I haven't had to worry about how I'm going to pay these bills. The first bill has already come due, the emergency room, and I was able to pay that completely in total. So thank you very much. I still have to pay for the ambulance ride because I took an ambulance up to another hospital to see the plastic surgeon. And then I have to pay for that emergency room and maybe the surgeon fees. I am confident that I have enough to pay for all these bills. The question is whether or not I'm going to need more surgery and how much that's going to cost. But regardless of all that, I want to thank everyone who was generous enough to donate. While I may never know who you are because some of you are anonymous, I want you to know that it is greatly appreciated, and I would hug you all if I could. So I feel a big cry coming on, so I'm going to log off now. So thank you, everyone. Stay safe. Take care of each other.
Cerakote is a polymer ceramic composite coating that can be applied to metals, plastics, polymers, and wood. It's also what will take your plain Jane firearm from basic to full custom. Whether you want a handgun coated in just a single color, your hunting rifle camouflaged for your specific environment, or your competition pistol sprayed in purple, white, and black Carolina Cryptic, you want Carolina Ceramic Coating to do the job. Bud and his team of skilled technicians will carefully disassemble and clean your firearm, professionally apply the Cerakote in your choice of colors and patterns, and return your firearm to you in perfect working order. And they also do auto engine parts. When I wanted my competition handgun Cerakoted, I trusted Carolina Ceramic Coating, and you should too. Check out their work on Instagram. Search at CerakoteNC, that's at CERAKOTENC, or go to CarolinaCeramicCoating.com.
Michael Bloomberg is pushing hard against the SHARE Act and concealed carry reciprocity using celebrities and virtually no production value at all.
In This Week in Anti-Gun Nuttery.
Okay, folks, it's go time. Michael Bloomberg, the only name in gun control, is launching an offensive. No, he's not using the blood in the streets of Las Vegas to push for a new assault weapons ban or an expansion of the NFA. Nope, he's just doubling down on his obvious opposition to the SHARE Act and concealed carry reciprocity. Before I get started, I have to reflect on the past and the present. Back when I was rooting for the anti-gun team, the anti-gun groups, namely the Brady Campaign and the Joyce Shell Group, the Violence Policy Center, were pushing their anti-gun agenda. The best the NRA could do was either hold the line and either blanket oppose the anti-gun bills or offer concessions like the 10-year sunset to the assault weapons ban or the clauses in the Brady background check where the government fails to issue a confirmation or denial, the system fails open rather than closed. So now it's flipped, and flipped bad for Bloomberg. First, the Brady campaign is dying, and I can't even remember the name of Mark Kelly's anti-gun group where he parades his wife, Gabby Giffords, around. This makes Bloomberg the only name in gun control. And if that meant something, like it did in the 90s, he'd be writing bills and driving public policy. Instead, he's reduced to making crappy internet videos that nobody watches. Crappy videos like this.
Here's one thing that can make a difference right now.
Right now, that only takes 5 minutes of your time.
Yep, it's one of those progressive videos where they pile a bunch of celebrities so lacking in actual fame that you might recognize one out of 10 of them. They hand them all the same simple script and let the editors go crazy jump cutting between these people who straddle the line between has been and never was. For those old enough to remember, it comes across as a preachy version of Max Headroom.
Max Headroom.
And this isn't even professional quality work. It appears they simply have the celebs film themselves on their cell phones whenever they feel like reading the script. The end result is as lame as you might think.
All you have to do is text reject.
Text reject.
REJECT. It'll connect you to every town for gun safety.
Slice little email.
You'll get a call right back from every town for gun safety, connecting you with your lawmaker and giving you guidelines on what to say.
Yep, their big plan is to weaponize their random cell phone videos into some sort of obnoxious anti-rights email chain letter. We're about to hear a bunch of B, C, and D-list celebrities read Michael Bloomberg's script to their representatives in hopes that the unwashed plebeians will get coached into reading the exact same script to their representatives. Our side is grassroots. The anti-gun side is Michael Bloomberg working his followers like a demented ventriloquist act.
Silence! I kill you!
Then they have this guy.
And don't be intimidated by making that call. I used to be in Congress. You're going to get voicemail. It's going to be easy, and it'll make a difference.
Are we supposed to know who this guy is? I actually did a little research to try to get a list of all the names of these people so I could figure out who some of them are and see if maybe I should know who some of them are. I can't even find who these people are, so I don't know who this guy is. Write me on the show page if you know who this guy is. And is this smart? I'm the dude on the other side who makes the phone calls against the anti-gun actions and for the pro-gun bills. You know what happens? I don't get to speak to Elizabeth Warren or my state representatives, but I frequently talk to their staffers. Sure, they listen to what I have to say, and if I was reading from a script, I never am, they hear out my propaganda. But they frequently ask questions or give a statement from the representative on why they support or oppose the bill. This is the exact thing that gets brainless automatons reading Michael Bloomberg's talking points with zero real understanding of the issue to sputter and stammer. I have no idea if the aides record this reaction, but if you're running a direct top-down political push, it can easily be distinguished from a grassroots movement this way.
Call your rep right now to reject NRA's radical agenda. Reply, call.
It can be this simple.
Radical agenda? We're talking about the SHARE Act and concealed carry reciprocity. Bills that remove foolish import laws where foreign-made firearms are illegal to import, but an American-made clone is 100% legal. Or removing suppressors, car mufflers for your gun, from the NFA. In a world where you get a ticket for driving your car with the muffler removed, you need to pay $200 and wait 6 months to a year for the same device for your gun. And a law that would say if an American is trusted and legal to carry a gun in their home state, they need no additional permitting or fees to carry in all 50 states. Radical agenda? In what way? This is the literal meaning of their often misused phrase, common sense. Now, it's time for them to read the script that they want you to parrot.
I'm calling to urge you to oppose the SHARE Act, which would roll back gun silencer safety laws.
It could make mass shootings even more deadly.
That would make mass shootings even more deadly than they are already.
How would a sound suppressor make a mass shooting more deadly? A suppressor lowers the muzzle report of a gun from the level of a jumbo jet on full thrust taking off to that of a jackhammer pounding sidewalk. And many of the people who witness shootings don't immediately recognize the sound of unsuppressed gunshots.
I also oppose concealed carry reciprocity legislation.
I oppose the concealed carry reciprocity legislation.
That would gut our state's gun laws.
With the exception of a few states here in the Northeast and California and Hawaii in the West, there are really only two types of concealed carry systems. States that will issue a permit to anybody who can legally buy a gun at a gun shop, and states that have abandoned the permits entirely. Since anybody who can't legally buy a gun at a gun shop can't legally own a gun, let alone carry one. Given that violent crime is dropping while gun ownership and concealed handgun permit numbers are growing, I think there's evidence that the few anti-gun high crime states that deny lawful citizens of their right to carry might just have it wrong.
I feel really strongly that the time has come to reject the NRA's dangerous agenda.
And put the safety of all Americans first.
Put the safety of all Americans first.
Again, gun ownership up, violent crime down. We should be putting the safety of America first. And the best way to do that is to reject Michael Bloomberg's agenda, which indeed is very radical.
We should not make it easy for people with dangerous histories to buy silencers.
Aren't these people the ones who keep telling us that background checks save lives? If these background checks are so great for guns, why aren't they good enough for suppressors? It's not like the suppressor is actually useful without attaching it to the gun. Oh, and both guns and suppressors are illegal for the dangerously mentally ill. Of course, Bloomberg has been working tirelessly to change the definition of mentally ill from one who's a danger to themselves and those that are around them to anybody we feel like stripping of their rights.
Concealed carry reciprocity will make our communities less safe.
How? The states that have removed their permitting system entirely have had a drop in violent crime. States with shall issue permitting are seeing a drop in violent crime. The small number of holdouts with outdated anti-rights laws are seeing a much less dramatic drop in violent crime, if not an increase. I think you got it backwards.
Please protect us. Thank you.
So here's the biggest fail. You're calling a politician and asking them to protect you? It's not like they're going to fly over and save you Superman style. It'd be smarter to call the cops. They have guns. Okay, on a serious note, we know they're saying, protect us with laws. Like the laws that ban murder, or assault, or robbery, or making threats. There is a deep flaw in your logic. Now, as a prolific podcaster and someone who's been harassed by Sean about audio quality, if a bunch of amateurs like us can come up with some decent audio quality, why can't billionaire Bloomy figure out how to make an anti-gun video that doesn't look and sound like a junior high school project? Can he hire some people? Do they think that bad production values lend authenticity to their haranguing? This just looks like they don't care and can't find anyone who does. I wanted to close out with another video I found on Every Town's YouTube channel. This one is them both dancing in the blood of the Las Vegas massacre, but also lamenting the defeat of their poorly written background check bill last year in Nevada. It's one of those undercover camera videos taken at a gun show, and this was consistent with all the exchanges.
You're a private seller?
Yeah.
So there's no background check?
As long as you're a Nevada resident.
So there's no background check?
You're not a Nevada resident and won't give me your driver's license, I won't sell it to you.
But otherwise there's no background check?
No.
Gone is the rhetoric of buying a gun, no questions asked. Because literally everyone they tried to buy a gun from at that show was asking to see ID. And they are asking to see ID because that is the only thing a private citizen can do. Because Michael Bloomberg and his followers have worked hard to make it that way. He's pushing lies, a failed agenda, and bad faith arguments.
In addition to appearing here, Weird is a regular host on The Squirrel Report and blogs at weirdworld.com. That's W-E-E-R-D world.com.
Plug of the week, the grass-fed gourmet cookbook. So Weird, you like to eat, right?
I like to eat and I like to cook.
Well, I have the book for you. It is the grass-fed gourmet cookbook, and I'm not entirely certain why we picked it up originally, but it has turned into like the go-to cookbook for the wife. It's a little bit on the pricey side for, you know, random cookbook. It's like $23, but I got one recipe in there that is worth $23 all by itself. As we started the podcast today, as before we were actually podcasting, we're doing the, you know, the let's work on the show notes, you know, the pre-show stuff that we do. I was just finishing up my leftover venison baked in sour cream, which in my version of the book is on page 45. Venison baked in sour cream is, I think, the second thing that my wife made out of the deer that somebody gave me a number of years ago. And when I shot my first deer myself last year, I think it was the very first thing I asked her to make. Will you make venison baked in sour cream sauce? Because this stuff, I mean, she's labeled it in the book as deer crack. It's the venison, obviously. It's got sour cream sauce, obviously. It's got some mushrooms and a few other odds and ends. And it is so good. It is so good that when one of our neighbors shot a deer and was unable to take his deer to the processing facility because it was too late and he didn't want to leave it overnight for the coyotes to get to because he has coyotes on his property too, he called the wife and said, hey, you know, I know that you know how to do this butchery stuff. You know how to like turn, you know, field dress the thing. Can you come give me a hand? So she runs off there and helping him, you know, all he really wanted to do was skin it and quarter it and he was going to deal with it later. And she starts talking to him about, well, you know, I could, you know, you can do a roast out of this and you can even do ribs if you want. There's a number of things you can do. And he likes to eat as much as I do. His mouth's watering. He says, I'll give you half the meat if you'll like break it down into roasts and stuff for me, if you'll get all the meat off the bone. Well, of course, what's the first thing I want? I want some more venison sour cream sauce. Well, she makes it. We eat it for dinner, and I'm like, so is there enough leftovers to have venison baked in sour cream pie afterwards? Well, there wasn't enough, but she hadn't finished butchering the deer, so guess what we had the very next day? She made some more of this stuff. So 2 days in a row, I'm eating venison baked in sour cream, and then it wasn't technically speaking leftovers because she just made enough. She made extra for this, and she turned that leftover into venison baked in sour cream pot pies, which I had the third day. So I had this stuff for like 3 days in a row. I skipped a day. I didn't actually eat the leftover because I couldn't. The pie was so big that we couldn't eat. I mean, I ate all of mine. The wife ate most of hers, and there was still some venison baked in sour cream left. So I ate that today, 2 days. It was like I skipped a day. So I didn't have it 4 days in a row. I had it 4 days in five. That's how good this stuff is. And my wife says that it's probably the go-to cookbook for a lot of the meat that she cooks. So check it out. Grass-fed gourmet cookbook. There's a link in the show notes. It's $23. It is worth it. And if you have venison, that's your first one. Do this. Venison baked in sour creams on my book. It's on page 45. And it also works, oddly enough, for emu.
Well, there you go. Just in case I shoot an emu.
I told you about the emu that we ended up with, right? We ended up with some emu meat. Yeah.
I did not.
This is what happens when you have cool friends. Friend of the show, John, who is the coordinator down here for Operation Blazing Sword, by one way or another, ended up with some extra emu meat.
Don't ask any questions. This emu fell off the back of a truck.
kind of, sort of. Yeah. You know, here's some emu, have some emu. So like, what do you do with emu? Well, you treat it like venison. And I'm like, well, we know what we're going to cook it into, right? So that's how we ended up the first time turning the venison in sour cream. You know, it was actually emu baked in sour cream that we turned into the pie. Well, I watched the wife do it and then ate more than my share. So yeah, check that out. It is fantastic. This book is worth the money. I'm not a big fan of like, let's have a cookbook, but this is the one. So go ahead and grab it.
Are there lots of other good things for if you do most of your hunting at the grocery store like I do?
Oh yeah, absolutely. It will cause you to consider buying some of the more high quality cuts of meat or getting in touch with your local farmer at the farmer's market or something like that who's got, well, grass-fed instead of just, you know, whatever that Kroger happens to have for you. But, you know, when you're going to put that kind of effort into it, sometimes it helps to have a little better ingredients, right?
I agree.
So a quick reminder, join GBVC Radio Group on Facebook and let us know what you think of this episode. Well, that's our show for the week. Remember that Gunblog VarietyCast Radio is a member of the Self-Defense Radio Network.
Find the show notes at gunblogvarietycast.com/episode167.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Gunblog VarietyCast. Music courtesy of Rob Allen at blog.roballen.com. You can subscribe to this podcast on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, and Google Play Music. This podcast is made possible by the Firearms Policy Coalition and by contributions from listeners like you. This is a URS production.